Welcome to Washington Today for Monday, July 19th, 2021. I'm Gary Starkoff. Thanks a lot for joining us today. Here are some of your headlines. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 700 points today as stocks fell over concerns of a rise in COVID cases would slow global economic growth. The Dow was down 725, ending the day at 33,962. That's the biggest decline since October. The NASDAQ was down 152, ending at 14,274, and the S&P fell 68 points, ending at 4,258. We'll have more on the economy from President Biden in just a few minutes. A federal court has issued the first criminal sentence in the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Paul Allard Hodgkins was sentenced today to 8 months behind bars. Speaking from a prepared text, Mr. Allard apologized and said he was ashamed of his actions on January 6th. He described being caught up in euphoria as he walked down Pennsylvania Avenue and then followed a crowd of hundreds into the Capitol building. The sentencing could set the bar for punishments of hundreds of other defendants as they decide whether to accept plea deals or go to trial. Meanwhile, the U.S. Capitol Police Department has a new chief, J. Thomas Manger, who was most recently the chief of police in Montgomery County, Maryland, over the past 15 years, has been named to the position following an extensive search. According to the Associated Press, Mr. Manger has also led the Fairfax, Virginia Police Department and held a leadership position in the Major Cities Chiefs Association. The decision comes as the Capitol Police and other law enforcement agencies are working to find the best way to secure the Capitol complex and how best to deploy the 2,300-person force that guards the building and the lawmakers inside it. And Afghan nationals who aided the U.S. war effort and their families will be temporarily housed at a U.S. Army base about 140 miles south of Washington, D.C., while they await final approval of their visas. We'll hear from the State Department spokesman Ned Price coming up. We begin in the state dining room at the White House, where President Joe Biden delivered remarks about the economy today. He urged lawmakers to move forward with his proposals, arguing the plans will tackle some of the most persistent economic challenges the country faces as the nation continues to recover from the coronavirus pandemic. Here is President Biden.
Before I took office, there was a lot of folks out there, making some pretty bold predictions about how things would turn out. You might remember some of the predictions that if I became president, we'd, quote, see a depression, the likes of which we've never seen, end of quote. Well, it's true that the economy was sputtering before I got here, adding only 60,000 jobs per month for 3 months before I was sworn in. But now, 6 months later, we've changed that. We've gone from 60,000 jobs per month to 60,000 jobs every 3 days. More than 600,000 jobs per month since it took office. More than 3 million new jobs, all told. That's the fastest growth, I'm told, at this point in any administration's history. Another prediction that is my favorite one, I must add, is that if I got elected, I'd bring the end to capitalism. I never understood that one, but we've heard an awful lot. Well, in 6 months into my administration, the U.S. economy has experienced the highest economic growth rate in nearly 40 years. And we know we knew that we needed to launch a wartime effort to get the America vaccinated and pass a powerful American rescue plan. We did both those things. And now the forecasters have doubled their projections for growth this year in the economy to 7% or higher. In fact, the U.S. is the only developed country in the world where growth projections today are stronger than they were before the pandemic hit. At the same time, companies across the country are giving workers a raise, unusual thing. And the number of new unemployment claims has been cut by more than half since I took office. And by the way, 2 weeks ago, I issued a major executive order promoting fair and open competition, which is the cornerstone of American capitalism, banning non-compete clauses that suppress workers' wages, lowering the price of things like hearing aids, prescription drugs, internet service, along with dozens of other actions. Folks, it turns out capitalism is alive and very well. We're making serious progress to ensure that it works the way it's supposed to work, for the good of the American people. So for all those predictions of doom and gloom 6 months in, here's where we stand. Record growth, record job creation, workers getting hard-earned breaks. Look, we brought this economy back from the brink.
President Biden speaking at the White House. During his remarks, he also touted the creation of 3 million jobs since he entered office and praised the passage of the American Rescue Plan. At the same time, he promoted a $600 billion infrastructure framework, one that's still being negotiated by a bipartisan group of senators. Last week, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer outlined his plans for this week and the infrastructure packages. He is set to file cloture on the framework bill that senators will later swap the bill, the infrastructure bill, into. That bill will need 60 votes to get past Wednesday's procedural vote. Some Republican lawmakers have expressed concern about setting a Wednesday deadline for the package, saying the goal should be to get it right. Here is Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell.
Remember, at the beginning of the year, the Biden administration inherited a historically strong economic trajectory. Thanks to the smart, targeted bipartisan policies we passed last year, our economy was primed to get millions of Americans back to work with competitive pay while consumers unleashed pent-up demand. But alas, that was before Democrats decided to pour $2 trillion into a long list of liberal pet pirate projects and insist on making it less appealing for workers to actually go back to work. Today, essentials like gas and groceries have gotten more and more expensive. Bigger purchases consumers had put off during the pandemic are getting even further out of reach. Across the country, working families and employers alike are feeling the pinch. An effective tax increase on both the wages and the savings of the middle class. Now, our colleagues weren't flying blind. They weren't naive. They knew they were passing what the White House Chief of Staff said was designed to be the most progressive domestic legislation in a generation. And they knew the risk, which one liberal economist described as, quote, inflationary pressures of a kind we have not seen in a generation. Sure enough, inflation just clocked the fastest year-on-year increase since 2008. But apparently, according to President Biden himself, the solution is, listen to this, even more of the same. Today, instead of deflecting attention from the fact that his administration's springtime approach was flat wrong, the president actually doubled down. He suggested the right way to shake this inflation was, listen to this, another $3.5 trillion in spending. This is the same reckless taxing and spending spree that Democrats dreamt up when they assumed our economy would be having the opposite problem. But now all that same borrowings, printing, and spending is supposed to be what the doctor ordered to fight inflation, inflate our way out of inflation? Let's hope the American people don't have to learn firsthand how that strategy would work out. Another multi-trillion dollar reckless taxing and spending spree, believe me, is the last thing American families need.
Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell earlier today. Remember, whenever the Senate is in session, you can find the proceedings on C-SPAN 2. This morning, C-SPAN's Washington Journal spoke with The Hill's Morgan Chalfant about President Biden's top priorities, including the infrastructure package.
So I think that he's really going to be focusing on building momentum and pushing this package as lawmakers and White House officials rush to get the final text of the bill finished before this Wednesday deadline that Leader Schumer has set for a vote on moving forward.
Although the news just happened over the weekend in terms of one of the ways to pay for this package was proposed boosting of funding for the IRS to improve tax collection. And that's now off the table. Any word from White House officials about that and what they think they can do to solve that funding issue?
So Biden's big red line has been not to raise taxes on individuals making $400,000 or less a year. I think the White House is open to ideas on pay-fors. They do want to see it paid for, but that's a big hurdle. I think that it's something that they're obviously going to have to work out pretty quickly as to what they can replace that pay-for with. And I think we'll see, you know, today and tomorrow what the position is from the White House on what might be a adequate swap out for that.
This also comes at a notable time for the White House, the president this week marking 6 months in office. What plans are set to mark that?
He's expected to deliver participate in a CNN town hall on Wednesday. I think that he'll get a lot of questions, obviously, on the continued recovery amid the pandemic and also the economic recovery and his broader economic agenda that he's trying to get passed through Congress.
We also mentioned earlier the president today and the first lady welcoming the King Abdullah, the King and Queen of Jordan, to the White House. Why are these events important for this president?
I think that engaging with foreign leaders is obviously something that we see every president do, but it's important for Biden because he's trying to restore some relationships abroad or change them after 4 years of unpredictability and some tumult under the Trump administration. And there are important opportunities for him to engage with foreign leaders and help explain and get them on board with his agenda as well. You saw the president do his first a trip abroad last month. That was obviously a very important for the moment for the White House to engage with European allies, bolster alliances like NATO, and also meet critically with the Russian president about a number of areas of disagreements. And it's also a signal of the White House trying to kind of return to normal. We've seen a number of these foreign leader visits in the last couple of months, and it really shows that they're trying to kind of return to a semblance of normalcy amid the pandemic, and Biden's able to meet in person with these foreign leaders.
Speaking of in person, we understand in this off-year election, the Virginia governor's race, the president will be campaigning for Terry McAuliffe.
Yes, he will. That is on the schedule for Friday. The president will be in Virginia campaigning with McAuliffe, one of his main major campaign events in his first term as president. So I think that, you know, we'll see him really try to build support for the gubernatorial candidate in Virginia on Friday.
The Hill's Morgan Chalfant on today's Washington Journal. You can find the entire program on our website at cspan.org/WJ. And during his White House event, the president also sought to clarify his previous remarks about Facebook. This comes days after he said the platform is, quote, killing people because of vaccine misinformation the social media giant allows to circulate on its platform. Here he is responding to a question from CNN's Caitlin Collins.
You said last week that companies and platforms like Facebook are killing people by letting
them... Let me be precisely what I said. I'm glad you asked me that question. One, I had just read that on the Facebook pointed out that it was pointed out that Facebook, of all the misinformation, 60% of the misinformation came from 12 individuals. That's what the article said. So I was asked that question about what do I think is happening? Facebook isn't killing people. These 12 people are out there giving misinformation. Anyone listening to it is getting hurt by it. It's killing people. It's bad information. My hope is that Facebook, instead of taking it personally, that somehow I'm saying Facebook is killing people, that they would do something about the misinformation, the outrageous misinformation about the vaccine. That's what I meant.
Have they done enough, in your opinion, to stop?
I haven't, to be completely honest with you. I don't know if they did anything today. Up to over the weekend, I don't think they had, but I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, accountable if they don't do more to stop the spread?
When you say hold accountable, I just want to, I'm not trying to hold people, I'm trying to make people look at themselves, look in the mirror. Think about that misinformation going to your son, your daughter, your relative, someone you love. That's what I'm asking, all the way in the back.
President Biden at the White House talking to the reporters earlier today. And according to Fox News, Tennessee Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn has written a letter to the president criticizing his administration's collaboration with Facebook and suggesting the work could violate the First Amendment. She wrote, quote, "These revelations are deeply concerning. The blatant actions by your administration to work with big tech companies to censor Americans' free speech are shocking and arguably a violation of the First Amendment." She also asked for more information on how exactly the White House is working with Facebook, asking, quote, "What criteria are you directing social media platforms to use to flag and remove posts? What criteria are you directing social media platforms to use to ban users?" You can read more of Senator Blackburn's letter at foxnews.com. Centers for Disease Control Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky said that 7 out of 10 children eligible to get the COVID-19 vaccine have not been vaccinated. She spoke during a virtual discussion hosted by the Health Action Alliance and the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Walensky encouraged parents to protect their children against the coronavirus and other diseases and talked about barriers to vaccinations and the role businesses can play in the effort. Here's Dr. Walensky.
Just last week, we learned that cumulative orders for vaccinations through the Vaccine for Children's program are down by more than 12 million doses since the start of this pandemic. Especially concerning are gaps for measles vaccine and other vaccines routinely recommended at 11 or 12 years of age, including meningococcal and Tdap. Protecting the health of our children is a critical public health and business priority. With the Delta variant spreading across the country, widespread vaccination is even more critical. The Delta variant is now well over half of all circulating virus in the country and is in fact more transmissible than the original, 2 to 3 times more. We need to get ahead and stay ahead of the virus by improving our vaccination rates. This will allow us to safely reopen schools and help employees reliably get back to work. Being vaccinated will allow our kids to safely get back to the things they have missed: in-person school, playing with friends, and participating in sports activities. Vaccinated individuals have very low risk of contracting COVID-19 or spreading it to others. And by being vaccinated, they add to community-wide protection for those who are unable to get vaccinated, such as younger siblings and other children who are not currently eligible. We are hopeful we have a safe and effective vaccine for younger children before the year is over. Vaccinating our children is more than just a way of getting them safely back at school. It's a way to save lives. Your voice here is critical. Since joining CDC, I have fought hard to share science-based information about the vaccine. I know not everyone wants to hear from me. Many actually want to hear from you, their employers, their colleagues, their trusted friends. Thank you for being there with information and with support to amplify our message. When our vaccination rates are higher, our families and our communities are safer, and our businesses can grow and thrive. While it's true that, relative to adults, fewer children have been sick with COVID-19, there have been 490 pediatric deaths due to COVID-19. I know that pales compared to more than 600,000 total lives lost to this pandemic. But those 489 pediatric deaths should shock us. Compared to the number of deaths to those of diseases for which we vaccinate, like influenza, during the 2019-20 flu season, the worst flu season of the decade, there were 199 pediatric flu deaths. With COVID-19, deaths are not the only concern. Pediatric COVID-19 disease also puts our children at risk for multisystem inflammatory syndrome, a rare but serious complication which has affected over 4,000 children in the United States, leading to more than 37 pediatric deaths. And there's also long COVID to worry about. We still don't have the complete picture as data in this age group are limited, but we do know that even children with mild cases of COVID may face serious long-term effects.
CDC Director Rochelle Walensky speaking to the American Academy of Pediatrics. Across the country, the daily number of COVID cases has soared by nearly 20,000 over the last 2 weeks to about 32,000 cases, while daily inoculations have sank to the lowest levels since January. And the Canadian government said today will ease border restrictions for fully vaccinated discretionary travelers from the United States beginning on August 9th. The announcement followed months of pressure in both the U.S. and Canada to ease the rules on non-essential travel at the border. You're listening to Washington Today. Welcome back. This is Washington Today. I'm Gary Starikoff. Here are a few more headlines. The Biden administration took another step toward its goal of shutting down the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center, releasing a Moroccan citizen who had been held without charges for nearly 19 years. The transfer of Abdullatif Nasser into the custody of Moroccan officials was a first by the Biden administration. It revived an Obama administration effort that had been blocked by conservative opposition and the difficulty of resolving the remaining cases, including finding secure sites to send some of the detainees. The United States and its allies accused China today of a global cyber espionage campaign, pulling together a broad coalition to publicly call out Beijing for hacking. The United States was joined by NATO, the European Union, Britain, Australia, Japan, New Zealand, and Canada in condemning the spying, which U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said posed, quote, a major threat to our economic and national security. At the same time, the U.S. Department of Justice charged four Chinese nationals with targeting dozens of companies, universities, and government agencies in the U.S. and abroad. And a new prime minister supported by key international diplomats will take charge in Haiti, an official said on Monday, a move that appeared aimed at averting a leadership struggle following the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. Ariel Henry, who was designated prime minister by Moïse before he was killed, but never sworn in, will replace the country's interim prime minister, according to the Associated Press. This morning, the Senate Rules Committee held its first field hearing in two decades, hoping to shine a spotlight on voting rights after Senate Republicans blocked a passage last month of the For the People Act. That was the sweeping bill that would overhaul federal elections. The hearing took place at the National Center for Civil and Human Rights in Atlanta, Georgia, a state that has become one of the battlegrounds for voting rights in the U.S. after the Republican legislature there passed a series of bills in March that made changes to how, when, and where Georgians can cast a ballot. None of the committee's Republican members attended the hearing, but Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell talked about the committee hearing late this afternoon on the Senate floor.
Now, on an entirely different matter, a few months ago, a group of Democrats and left-wing activists brought the state of Georgia into the national spotlight. Tremendous outrage, an air of total crisis, was cooked up out of nowhere. The state of Georgia was passing a mainstream, common-sense election law. It combined widely popular integrity protections like voter ID, with a great deal of flexibility and availability to make voting easy. It codified more flexible early voting and more flexible mail-in voting than many Democrat-run states offer, for example, New York. Americans want to make it easier to vote and harder to cheat. Voter ID, for example, is popular with majorities of Black, white, and Hispanic Americans. But in their ongoing bid to mount a Washington, D.C. takeover of our nation's elections, Democrats seized on this mainstream law and decided to start shouting that the sky was falling down in Georgia. The sky is falling down in Georgia. Unfortunately for the people of Georgia, many people in the press and corporate America bought it. They got Major League Baseball to move its All-Star game out of Georgia. Actual work opportunities, actual prosperity for working people were sacrificed to serve this fake hysteria. Well, today, Georgians got what you might call a very weak consolation prize. Today, a week after the All-Star game was supposed to happen in Atlanta, Democrats themselves descended on the state to stage a bit of partisan theater. Last week, the traveling roadshow was Texas Democrats coming here to Washington to beg Senate Democrats to seize power away from their own citizens and local governments. This week, it was our own colleagues' turn to get on the jets, but the rhetoric was just as hysterical, and the conclusion all the same. Washington Democrats need to grab unprecedented power and rewrite all 50 states' election laws. It's the same shtick we've been hearing here in this chamber for multiple years now. Remember, their sweeping takeover bill was written long, long before any of the state laws which they now claim are prompting it. This phony outrage is wearing thin on the American people. Citizens know it isn't attacking democracy to have things like common sense voter ID and common sense voter list maintenance, alongside lots of early voting, lots of mail-in voting, and lots of election day voting. That kind of combination isn't an attack on democracy. It is the definition of democracy. It's exactly what Americans want.
Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell earlier today on the Senate floor. Georgia Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock joined a group of local officials at this meeting in Atlanta as witnesses at the hearing. Here is the committee chair, Amy Klobuchar, speaking at the hearing.
We are here in one of the states today where legislation was signed into law by Georgia's governor in March. The new Georgia law not only limits the number and availability of ballot drop boxes and puts limits on the hours of early voting, it also strips power away from local election officials and ultimately puts it in the hands of the state legislature, something that Reverend Senator Warnock has introduced a bill to change. This new law also reduces the time for runoff elections from 9 weeks to 28 days. And since Georgia law requires voters to be registered for at least 29 days before the election day, this means that previously unregistered voters won't be able to make their voices heard in the runoffs. Do you think it's a coincidence that it's 28 days for the runoff and then 29 days? When you register, it's not one bit of coincidence. It is a blatant exercise of raw power. It also limits early voting for runoffs to 1 week, Monday through Friday, so you can't vote on weekends, allows a single person to challenge the registration of an unlimited number of voters, and makes it a crime for volunteers to give food and water on a nonpartisan basis to people in line. With similar bills now being considered in state legislatures across America, or signed into law already, this is a coordinated effort to limit Americans' freedom to vote. Our Constitution, in Article 1, Section 4, has equipped us to do exactly what we should do. That provision makes clear that Congress has the power to make or alter laws governing federal elections at any time. It is as clear as day. We must meet this moment. As President Biden said in Philadelphia last week, this is the test of our time. That is why we are here to hear firsthand about the attack on voting rights in Georgia, why we must pass the For the People Act, which we're all co-sponsors, of which Senator Merkley is the chief sponsor. This would create those basic federal voting rights that are allowed for by our Constitution, that were clearly anticipated in our Constitution, as well as cut down on the dark money in our politics and do something about ethics reform.
Senate Rules Committee Chair Amy Klobuchar in Atlanta. The hearing is expected to be the first in a series of hearings by the committee looking at voting and campaign finance reforms. Afghan nationals who aided the U.S. war effort along with their families will be temporarily housed at a U.S. Army base while they await final approval of their visas, the State Department confirmed on Monday. According to a report in Politico, the first round of applicants will be taken to Fort Lee, Virginia, about 140 miles south of Washington, D.C. The news comes as the Biden administration has also been considering housing the applicants outside of Afghanistan before they come to the U.S. Many of them served as interpreters and translators for the U.S. forces and fear they are in danger amid the U.S. withdrawal and rapid gains by the Taliban. Here is State Department spokesman Ned Price.
Let me just explain a little bit how this is functioning internally. And we spoke about this somewhat late last week. But as you heard on July 19th, today, officially, the Department of State activated the Afghanistan Coordination Task Force. And that is a task force that, as you heard last week, is led by three-time Ambassador Tracy Jacobson. It consists of experts not only from the Department of State, but also from the Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security, and the Department of Health and Human Services. And it is that task force that will coordinate our efforts across the government to take qualified SIV applicants out of harm's way and to bring them to the United States once their security vetting is complete. And so when we talk about this group today, this is a group of SIV applicants and their family members who have completed that step, the security vetting process, the rigorous process that is required before we would bring SIV applicants and their families to the United States. We are also working to bring applicants who have passed the Chief of Mission screening, but don't yet have that final step, that security vetting procedure, which is called a security advisory opinion. This group, again, a separate group from the 2,500 referenced earlier, includes about 4,000 applicants, as well as their family members. And we, our plan is to take them to locations outside of the United States, where they will be safe and where they will be provided accommodation during this processing period, which can last a number of months. But as we have said before, we are striving to shorten these processing times at every stage of the process. And I spoke last week about how we have been able to do that by surging personnel, by moving the locus of some of these operations back to the Washington, D.C. area. And the increasing number, the increasing rate at which we've been able to approve SIV applicants in recent months. And you've seen the upward trajectory of that. We released our most recent quarterly report last week. We will have the next quarterly report in several months, and we certainly expect that increased processing to continue. I also will say that we do hope to expect to provide you an opportunity to hear directly from members of this task force, those who are leading it. We'll have more details for you on that tomorrow.
That's State Department spokesman Ned Price. The Afghan nationals are seeking refuge in the U.S. through the Special Immigrant Visa Program, which has enjoyed bipartisan support since its creation in 2009. The group heading for Fort Lee includes 700 who qualify for the program, along with 1,800 of their family members. And Amazon founder Jeff Bezos defended himself from critics who argue that billionaire tycoons like himself would be better off focusing on problems around the world rather than embarking on missions for space travel. The former Amazon CEO spoke to CNN today as part of a media blitz before blasting off into space later this week. The launch comes after Virgin Galactic founder Richard Branson made a test flight to the edge of space on July 12th. Here is Jeff Bezos.
Now, Jeff, there have been a chorus of critics saying that these flights to space are, you know, just joyrides for the wealthy and that you should be spending your time and your money and energy trying to solve problems here on Earth. So what do you say to those critics?
Well, I say they're largely right. We have to do both. You know, we have lots of problems in the here and now on Earth, and we need to work on those. And we always need to look to the future. We've always done that as a species, as a civilization. We have to do both. And what our job at Blue Origin is to do, and what this space tourism mission is about, is having a mission where we can practice so much that we get really good at operational space travel, more like a commercial airliner and less like what you think of as traditional space travel. If we can do that, then we'll be building a road to space for the next generations to do amazing things there. And those amazing things will solve problems here on Earth. And by the way, maybe it'll be Oliver. He's 18 years old. Maybe he'll found a space company that uses the infrastructure that this generation is building right now. So the real answer is yes, we have to do both.
Jeff Bezos appearing on CNN. He will blast into space on Tuesday in the first crewed flight of his rocket, which is called New Shepard. He will be joined by his brother Mark Bezos and Wally Funk, an 82-year-old pioneer of the space race, and you heard him mention an 18-year-old student. They will travel in a capsule with the biggest windows flown into space, offering stunning views of Earth. New Shepard was built by Mr. Bezos' company, Blue Origin, and is designed to serve the market for space tourism. A reminder that all of our coverage is online anytime at cspan.org. And if you missed any of this program, you can find it at cspan.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Gary Sterikoff. Thanks a lot for listening today to Washington Today.